Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, you know what? One advantage of having snow on the ground in April, there aren't any bugs bothering you outside, at least. And we will talk a little bit about that with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab a while back, but still stops by to talk with us about insects every few months. You may have a question about ticks. What about insects that are roaming around in your house right now? What about whether or not these insects are going to be harmed or maybe helped by the kind of weather we've had? Join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of news about birds dying and, you know, problems with the birds with all this snow, the robins and so forth that came up early. My father-in-law had a photo of a robin sitting on, has been sitting on his feeder, parked on his feeder, eating all his suet. But it you know, caused me to think about our insect populations as well and whether this weather hurts or helps them.
Probably neither. You know, everybody, we just didn't wake them up. I mean, I've rarely seen the winter by itself have much of an impact unless we get incredibly cold weather. What seems to have the biggest impact on insects is if you wake them up and then slam the door with cold weather. And we really never got warm enough to wake much up. And so,
yeah.
So far, what this would suggest is, you know, just like the plants are going to be late in blooming, the insects are going to be late in getting active. It's a little early to call because you don't know what the summer weather will be. You know, there are certain years where we start with early springs and it stays very warm that we even see additional generations out of some of the Wisconsin insects. So now right now that would be far less likely just because, again, we're starting the clock so late. But I think that what this underlines, though, is for people who traditionally use calendars for predicting when the insects are going to come, it's not going to work so well this year. I'm everything, you know, I would guess it's going to be delayed for a week or two if things get normal from now on in.
Yeah.
And so that's why so often in our extension bulletins, when we're talking about treating or looking for various insects, we use the blooming of various plants, because just like insects, they use heat to kind of develop. And, you know, the warmer it is, the faster it happens, the cooler it is, the slower.
Yeah. Well, ticks, are they going to be out in force pretty
quick?
Well,
you know, the thing I always warn people about, especially deer ticks, which is our biggest concern, if there is no snow on the ground and it's 45 degrees, so you can go from no ticks to being right in the middle of tick season in 3 or 4 days if the conditions change. So, you know, down here, I'm guessing by this weekend, again, it's going to be warm enough and the snow's going to melt off. Way up north, it might be another 3 weeks, you know, with 3 feet of snow on the ground. But that's, you know, compared to when I was a child, you know, the tick season really didn't get going until you got into May, and then it was pretty much done by late July. Now it's anytime there's no snow on the ground, you really do have to keep your guard up if you're outdoors.
You know, thinking about northern Wisconsin with all the snow that has fallen, you wonder if this is not going to create more pools and puddles and more insect, more mosquitoes.
So the biggest problem we have up north is from a group we call the snowmelt mosquitoes. Mm. And if you get a lot of spring flooding, it sets the conditions right. The good news, there's only one generation a year of those, but it can make things miserable in May and June if conditions are right. And boy, I think we're kind of setting up for that because it's all these woodland ponds and like that might only exist for, you know, 4 or 5 weeks in the spring. But boy, can you generate a lot of mosquitoes from those.
Yeah. Tom in Wanakee has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I'm calling about what I know will appear, the Japanese beetles. Phil, last year we talked, and I had mentioned I have linden, the basswoods, in Wanakee. And you had mentioned, of course, that Wanakee was a wonderful place for the Japanese beetles to, I guess, generate. But anyway, I had been using Bayer insect and the pest concentrate, and you had mentioned that we shouldn't be using that, I guess, on the lindens because there was something that they were
Yeah. What has happened?
I believe for the butterfly.
Well, really more for bees. And so if you look at the new labels of product, it is no longer allowed to be used on lindens because the systemic chemical is moved into the nectar. And being such a good bee or pollinator plant, EPA has decided that this is just not acceptable. So it could be used on birches and some other things that are really not as attracted to bees, or especially because of the bloom period and the like.
What can I use in lieu of the bear?
Well, I mean, here's where we get to the problem: is there are plenty of chemicals that'll kill the Japanese beetles, but as far as a systemic product, we're really kind of handcuffed here. And so then you get caught with having to spray. And if you've got big trees, how the devil do you spray them? And what was the advantage of using the systemic too is one treatment got you through a season. Anything you use as a foliar treatment is only probably going to give you at best 7 days worth of control. Plus, you can't contain the spray near as well as you can using the systemic, so we're kind of handcuffed. Now, there are probably a couple products that can be used by professional arborists where they inject into the trunk, will give you similar results to the imidacloprid product that you were using in the past. But, you know, you're always leery when you start injecting things in trunks. You're creating wounds, and is that going to cause a complication? So the unfortunate answer is I'm not sure we've got as good an answer. As I said, there are some moderate fixes that can be used, but they're going to be a lot more bothersome to work with and also have environmental issues. Now, the good news on the lindens is this is not a life or death. It's a cosmetic damage to the tree. But in bad years, it can, you know, take the top half of the tree out, so there's no leaves, and the ones that are left are brown and fallen. So where it will be this year, I hate to make Japanese beetle predictions other than, you know, what we witnessed in your area of Wanakee with all the development going on. There was lots of new sodded areas going in, and so it gave new territory for the Japanese beetle to get going, because definitely things are far more intense in Wanakee than it is on the west side of Madison, where I live, where we've had, you know, Japanese beetle issues now for probably almost 20 years. And it seems it's that initial push, that first 5 to 7 years is when they cause the most problems.
Yeah.
Is there any way to treat the turf?
Well, here's the dilemma. You know, there are things that are used for killing them, but I can guarantee you the Japanese beetles that are messing with you are coming from somewhere else. It's typically not in people's lawns. If your lawn started to die because of grub damage from Japanese beetles, it's very appropriate to do the turf. But most of the time what we see is that the Japanese beetles are coming in from hundreds of yards, if not half a mile or more. In my neighborhood, I was within a couple blocks of a golf course, so that's where we were catching most of our misery. The populations have declined in the golf course considerably, so that's helped. But again, with some of the new developments in your area, and especially it's irrigated turf that is the best for Japanese beetle breeding.
No.
Because then their grubs always have, and that's why there's this association with golf courses. So, you know, I tease about this. This is not practical, but, you know, the old hurricane-generating machines in the movies, the giant wind, you know, if you knew where they were coming from and you could get enough wind going, they could never make it to you. But, of course, that's not going to be
practical. That's not going to happen. There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Tom. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You have a tick question or maybe a question about caterpillars, other insects, give a call. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Luann from La Crescent, Minnesota, emailed to ask how she can prevent centipedes from entering her home. She found half a dozen centipedes over the last week in the bathroom and bedroom.
Okay, so the thing, just to make sure we're talking about the same critter, is that you know, centipedes have very long legs, are very fast, and we have two groups of centipedes that we run into. By far, the most common is only found indoors, it's a very quick centipede. And you know, they live in the walls. In the winter, the walls are cold enough that they're really not active. Things are warming up enough now between your house and the sun that it does wake them up. The number you're finding is pretty staggering. I mean, what's typical for centipedes is finding, you know, one every 2 or 3 months, usually active at night, and you turn the light on and they go scurrying away, and that's what kind of freaks people. Now, the other critter that's sometimes mistaken are millipedes, and millipedes are much slower. You can't really see the legs on these things. And what millipedes are pretty much an outdoor critter that migrates in. Same kind of thing, though. It's warming up enough that things could wake up. They fall into things like the bathtub, and they can't get out, so they often die in there. And now, for millipedes, you know, the two ways you can approach it is to treat the outside of the house to kill them before they get in, or to try to make sure that every vent and pipe, everything's caulked tight enough that they can't crawl in, they can't squeeze in. That same strategy would work for outdoor centipedes, but I just don't see that much migration for outdoor centipedes. They pretty much stay under the rocks and living outdoors and in the mulch rather than coming indoors. They do treat along the outside of the house for these things, again, to give you a physical barrier. Now, for the indoor centipedes, the problem with spraying for those is that you often can't spray where it really would do the most good. And because they are slow to breed, what I'd often suggest to people, I mean, you can use an indoor ant spray and spray it back in the corners and in areas where you think they might be coming from. But one of the other things to do is to use these passive traps, these, you know, sticky board traps, which are basically just a very tacky glue that's put on a piece of cardboard. And you can slide this underneath the stove and other out of the way places. When the centipedes come running across, they get caught in it. And so you physically capture and kill them in that method. And as I said, the reason you're normally not overrun with centipedes in a house is centipedes eat other insects and creatures for a living, and there's just not that much food.
Right.
They're also slow to develop. They don't reproduce fast, so you just don't get these population explosions. With the outdoor millipedes, if conditions are right, and we can get buckets full of those, and they're often migrating in from elsewhere, as I mentioned, they definitely can't breed indoors. So, as I said, if it's the quick, you know, freak you out type of creature, then I think these little glue boards and maybe a little ant spray back in the cracks and crevices would help. It also helps the less clutter you have in the basement, just because there's so many little places for them to hide and the like. But that's often not practical because everybody has a cluttered basement. I mean, that's part of owning the house.
I was thinking about my basement. Oh, my goodness. All right, there we go. Thanks so much for that question, Luann. Steve in Pittsville has something for us. Hi, Steve.
Hey. Now, in the fall and winter when I'm out cutting firewood, and I'll cut into like a hollow oak tree, and we'll find these huge white grubs in there. They're bigger than like a June bug grub. Mm-hmm. What insect is that?
Most likely stag beetles, which are a great big, you might see stag beetles up your way June and July at lights. They're great big chestnutty brown, with the males have these great big pincers on the front. You find those in there. And then another one that looks almost identical, there is a type of scarab beetle, which again is related to the June bugs. Osmoderma, or the leather beetle is the fancy name I know it under. It looks like a huge June bug. It's about the size of a 50-cent piece. Both those grubs of the stag beetles and Osmoderma are found in that decaying, punky, as you say, kind of the heart rot you find in some trees. The grubs are in there after. They don't cause that, but they are associated with that decay and the like. So, you know, interesting creatures. They're really, you know, pretty much neutral in as far as causing any people problems, although I would not put my finger in the jaws of a stag beetle. That would give you a little bit of a pinch. But other than that, I said nothing to be concerned about. And when you do find them, as I said, it tells you you've got some decay going on within the wood.
Yeah.
Right. I never figured them to be a problem. I always just wondered what they were.
Yep. There you have it, Steve.
If you keep them in an old coffee can or whatnot, what they'll do is spin down a cocoon, and then you will eventually get one of the adults out. So,
hey, maybe I'll try this.
Yeah, why not? Thanks, Steve. Appreciate the call. And let's go to Alan in La Crosse now. Hi, Alan.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a two-species question. We moved into a house last fall, and there's a pretty large number of Japanese beetles in the house. Is the best way to get them out of the house by simply opening the door on a warm day, or am I going to look at bringing other things in at that process?
Sure. So the critter you've got is the Asian lady beetle, and there's often confusion just because, you know, the Japanese beetles eat your roses, Asian lady beetles invade your house, and all that happened last fall, and now what's happening is they're waking up. They will find their way out. You know, and so whether I don't think you can do much to aid it. The thing to consider for next year is, you know, as you're washing windows or anything else when you're working around the house, anything you can seal up. I would check all my attic vents and the like to make sure they're screened, and if there's any kind of seams and stuff, you know, stuffing it with steel wool or, you know, caulking it tight, because it's an access issue. And typically the invasion starts after we get the first hard freeze, and then we get the nice sunny days in end of September through October, and then they come pouring in. And whether they get in your wall voids or get your attic, then you pay for it all winter long. And now as it's warming up, what you're witnessing are the ones that have survived. And they don't all survive, but the ones that do survive are just trying to find their way out. And
okay, so they typically like to come in during what we call our Indian summer.
Yes, classic. And you know, it's weird. Once in a great while, we'll get a fall where we never quite get there, and then all of a sudden, when it gets cold, it stays cold, and we don't have this invasion. But more typically, it happens. And, you know, one of the other alternatives is to spray the outside of the structure at the appropriate time. I would normally tell people that's towards the end of September. I have seen the invasion as late as Halloween at the very end of October, but that was an unusual fall. And even then, the sprays would help. But why we always try to preach the physical sealing is if you figure out how they're getting in, that's a permanent solution, which the problem with the fall sprays, it's every fall you got to spray, because whether you spray one year to the next really doesn't matter as far as the populations you'll see the following year.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, second species of my question is ticks. I'm considering doing tick traps this year, and I was wondering when is the best. I understand there's like two times a year that you want to put them out, make sure they're fresh and put them out.
Okay, now are you putting the ones out with the treated cotton balls where the mice pick the product up? Okay. I would think the spring is really the best time to do it. Yes, you know what, I was disappointed when this technology came out. I mean, what's so exciting about it is a small amount of insecticide, you're getting a whole lot of positive results rather than spraying. I mean, people can spray areas too, but this is a much more target approach. But it was so darn expensive when it first came out that it really wasn't practical for most people. Because the peak activity of ticks is the spring, I think early season is the best time. Again, once we get to the point the snow's off the ground, the ticks would be active, it's perfectly appropriate to put it out. Now, the fall of the year is, with deer ticks, we're getting into the next generation. So there's nothing wrong with the fall of the year either, but you know, I think you get the more benefit, if I had to pick the two, the spring application, or now, you know, it doesn't matter. You fine, I'd say you should have done it last fall. Well, we're not there. So
Norman Fox Point emailed to tell us he found this year a deer tick on February 28th.
Yeah. No, I was humbled, and I think it was about the 15th of January, I received a tick from the Spooner area. And it was, again, we had this warm spell in January. Somebody was out hiking, and they found a deer tick in January. So, as I said, if there's no snow on the ground, you really do have to at least be aware that there's a possibility. So things will change very quickly with that. But
out in the spring will help with the life cycle?
Oh, definitely, because, you know, the whole idea is that the immature stages of most of the tick species we have concentrate on mice. And so what you're doing is giving the mice, you know, some nesting material. They take it back. So you're basically shutting the population down right there.
Yeah.
Has the DNR ever considered, like, littering these cotton balls?
I know of groups that have discussed it. I was talking to a group in the northwest part of the state a couple years ago, and they were looking at maybe getting a grant, and they were going to use drones to drop the things and the like. On that larger scale, no. Has in smaller scales, not in this state, but out in the east in particular, out in Connecticut and New Hampshire, where they've had quite a bit of Lyme disease. I know they have used these in various state parks and whatnot to help reduce the numbers, but you know, it is not inexpensive, and you know, like everything in nature, you can do it now, but 2 years from now, if you're not continuing the process, the tick numbers will come back. And so I think it's in very sensitive areas with a lot of people traffic is where it might be considered a more practical approach. But no, I don't know of the DNR of making any conversations at all as far as doing any kind of major tick control.
Yeah, Alan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri. You have a question about an insect? I hope you'll join in. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. If you've got an insect question, you want to post it up there, that'd be great. Let's go back to the phones, and this time we're going to Michelle in Scales Mound, Illinois. Thank you so much for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi. I have a problem with cluster flies. Mm-hmm. And last fall, with the box elder bugs and the Asian beetles coming in, we had a ton of these cluster flies. Also, and they've been coming out all through the fall, and it was really bad in my upstairs rooms. And I was wondering how I can prevent that next year.
Okay. So it's really the same thing with all these fall invaders. It's all happening in September and early October. With that history, what it suggests to me is it's either your soffits on your overhangs or the venting of your roof is allowing them to get access. And so it, you know, as we talked before, if you can figure out how they're getting in and get it tightened up so they can't get in, we're done. You know, we don't have to worry about this. And it, with that pattern, that's what it suggests. Once they get in the attic space, they can come down through your light fixtures or other electrical fixtures to get into your living space. You know,
oh, we had thousands of them. It was kind of disgusting. So I really don't want to have to do that again. So
yeah, how long have you been in the house?
Sure, we check it out. We have an old part of the house and a new part of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And we did get all new windows in the old part of the house, but I'm thinking maybe the attic needs to look.
Yeah.
Maybe the venting of the attic is not tight as it should be.
Yeah, I mean, what they'll do sometimes is put screening that's big enough to keep the birds out, but, you know, the spacing between the screening is enough that insects can squeeze in. And so purely by putting a smaller screening on, that's often sufficient. You know, what they'll often do, the windows are fine, but it's a question of what's going on in the walls. And, you know, with a lot of newer construction, they'll use house wraps and Tyvek, which basically puts a pretty tight seal that makes it much more difficult from the insects to get through the siding and then into your living space. But in older construction, you know, that doesn't exist. And so there's these spaces in the walls that's what the bugs are getting in to be sheltered by the winter. And then when they start to wake up, they filter, you know, they're not smart enough to remember how they got in, so they filter through any kind of light, which could be around the window frames. It, as I said, could be light fixtures, but, you know, sometimes people call me and say, it's just one bedroom, you know, and again, that makes it easier to at least look to where the potential is, but I think it's well worth getting in the attic. And then the other thing is just think about an insect squeezing into things. And what I'm seeing in some of the overhangs is they just drop these little plastic panels in. So again, you know, rodents and birds can't get in, but my little insect friends can squeeze in pretty much between the seams. And that's where it's worth getting up there with a caulk gun or something else and tighten that up. And then you're done. Now, cluster flies breed on earthworms. And it turns out in very somewhat wet years, there's more worms. That means there's more cluster flies. In extremely dry years, we don't seem to have a whole lot of issues with cluster flies because there's just not the worm populations to get the populations breeding. But and the other interesting thing is it depends where your house is located. The more exposed your house is, the more of these fall invaders you attract. You know, you get the same house in the middle of a woods where the sun really never gets to, and we find the insects don't seem to find it. And what the insects are using are visual cues, and it's the sunny contrast between where the sun's hitting the south side and those shady areas of the overhangs. It's like a magnet, you know, and for some of these insects, you literally are drawing them away from hundreds of yards away. And so, you know, the most beautiful place to put your house is up on a top of a ridgetop overlooking a valley. As far as cluster flies and Asian lady beetles and the like, unfortunately, that's the worst place to put it because you can draw them in from such a distance.
There you go, Michelle. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Now, again, for Michelle, you know, if you can't seal it up, you can contract for a service to come out in the fall, and they can apply some products that will make a major difference. Now, people's expectations, you know, if I tell somebody it's going to kill 90 to 95%, you know, I'm excited because of the great reduction. But if you're talking about tens of thousands of insects, unfortunately, you still get a few.
5% of 10,000 is still a lot.
It's a lot of critters.
There you go. Thanks again, Michelle.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. We turn next to Raquel in Waukesha next. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you.
What can we do for you?
I have a question. Last year, we were hit very hard with stink bugs, and I just need to know, is there a safe way to eliminate them that's not a harmful chemical to the people in the house?
Well, you know, typically most people just physically capture them and squeeze them. You know, so they do them in that way.
But then they stink.
Yeah. Well, you can try, and this is going to get a little tricky because we're right on the edge. There are soap products that will kill. In fact, even I would try something like Windex, you know, because it penetrates so well. What makes stink bugs a little bit more difficult than some other insects is the thicker the skin on an insect, the less effective the soap is. But I'm thinking something like Windex or other cleaners will penetrate through it quite quickly and do it in. You know, if it was a thick beetle, I'd say, maybe that's a little bit too hard to penetrate. But I would try something like Windex. Honestly, when I've gotten a pinch, I've used that for controlling wasp nests. It's not my first choice, but if I got nothing else around, and it really did work quite well.
Okay, so would you actually spray the windows to prevent them from...
No. So again, this is this fall invasion problem, and this is the new kid on the block for us. I teased my friend PJ. This is why I got retired, because I knew this one was coming, and it's not going to be a fun one as the numbers continue to increase. But the stink bugs...
totally huge. Increase from the last year.
Right. And this is kind of what we're hearing. We're finally getting to this point. You know, this phenomena happened 15 years ago out east, you know, and we could see how bad it can get. And it's surprised me a little bit how slow it's been coming. But, you know, it's the point that out east people were seeing thousands in their house during a winter. And you can imagine how annoying that's going to be. So again, we go back to it's all a fall invasion. Everything you're seeing now, nothing's breeding in your walls. This is just things that have woken up that have survived the winter in your walls. And so, you know, the first strategy is trying to tighten things up. And if that doesn't work, if you're inclined to use sprays, you wouldn't spray indoors. That doesn't gain you anything. But you spray outside when they're trying to invade. And this would be usually in September and the like. But once you get them, as I said, you deal with them, whether you throw them outside, you know, spraying the Windex on the window before the stink bug gets in is going to do you nothing, because there's no residual there. The only thing that the Windex would be useful for, if the stink bug's in front of you now and I want to spray, and it would kill it then. But that's why I mentioned most people just physically collect them and put them out. And as I said, in frustrating cases, you know, you're spraying around your window casings and other squeeze points on the outside in the fall to stop the problem.
There we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. We'll move on to Chris in Sun Prairie now. Hi, Chris. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, you betcha. So I want to create a better environment for native pollinators. I got a lot of bumblebees coming on my garage, but first my garage environment changes when I clean it out in the spring. So how can I make my yard environment hospitable for bumblebees and mud bees and other native pollinators that aren't honeybees?
Yeah, it really, when you look at the environments that these things require to be able to breed, that's really the direction you have to take things. And so, you know, what you find with bumblebees is they nest in cavities. So whether you have old chipmunk burrows or, you know, people have even had some success with little birdhouses that they put on the ground, you know, with a single opening, and sometimes the birds find it, but sometimes the bumblebees find it. Sometimes the yellow jackets find it. So, you know, it's a little hard to discriminate in this case of which the two. And bumblebees usually are pretty reasonable to have around. Yellow jackets, maybe not so much. You know, for the other ground nesting bees, you need bare soil. you know, and so, you know, that's something normally we don't think about in the backyard. We, you know, have plants all over the place and in a lot of cases just grass, which is kind of a bee desert. There's just no good places to live. The other thing you will see is that there's a number of these native bees that utilize little round straw-like environments. And so people are taking boards and drilling various size holes into the boards to provide environment. Now, in nature, what you're finding is there are bark beetle holes in dead trees that are out in the forest that what the bees are utilizing. If you go on the internet, you'll find just some incredibly artistic bee houses that people have gotten where they use various different size holes and they construct them in a kind of a geometric pattern. So they're really quite attractive, but yet they provide an environment that is kind of tough for a bee to find. So it just depends which of the bees you're trying to go. But for the bumblebees, as I said, considering that they're cavity dwellers, you're trying to provide them they're really not diggers themselves. They're utilizing pre-existing things. So, you know, little washed out areas under slabs and those kind of things are what they're looking for.
And we'll move on now to Tammy in Eau Claire. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. You guys have been talking a lot about our buddies, the Japanese beetles.
Yeah.
And something I have found effective, and I'd like Phil's opinion, I have been using Milky Spore as a preventative, and it seems to be both a good reducer of Japanese beetles and grubs, as well as reducer in getting rid of the moles that eat those grubs. Mm-hmm. Can you give any validation one way or the other?
Yes, but the point with Milky Spore is where you put it will really drastically reduce grub populations and really for an extended period of time. The weird or interesting thing about Milky Spore disease is it's self-generating, is when a grub becomes infected, the number of bacteria increase dramatically. When it dies, it's releasing tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of spores back in the ground, so it tends to build. Now, one of the problems, though, is if you don't have Japanese beetle around, it's not worth putting the stuff on. And secondly, what we find is that, as we had talked about earlier in the show, is a lot of times the Japanese beetle problems are coming in from down the road and you have no control of it. So that's why I was always hesitant. It's a somewhat expensive treatment. It's very appropriate in some cases if I know that the source of the grubs are my lawn or my lawn is being destroyed by the grubs, then it really is very, very direct way. Now, in development now, there are some other bacterial products that are being looked at that are more of a foliar contact spray. So we can use a similar strategy of using a naturally occurring bacterium. And when the Japanese beetles come on my roses, I spray it with them. And, you know, I've seen results. As far as I'm aware of, they have not come to the marketplace yet, but they're in development. So we've got a, you know, biological method of taking it. It's just a different bacterium. It doesn't work quite the same way as Milky Spore, but in a sense it does. But as I said, as far as I know, they have not quite made it to the market yet. And it'll be curious to see if it's a big enough market to make it worth the effort of a company to develop it, but you know, kind of an exciting source. So, you know, Milky Spore is a great long-term solution in the right situations. My experience is a lot of people have been using it where it's not, they're not really gaining much from it. Because again, I go back to the point is that most of us that are suffering Japanese beetle damage to our plants are suffering it because their beetles are flying in from areas around and not in our own lawns.
Huh. Would a golf course have, I mean, it'd be a huge amount of money for a golf course, I suppose. But
yeah, it depends. You know, a lot of the original, you know, Milky Spore disease goes back 60 years or so, was done out east and very successful. If you get the right conditions, it is a semi-permanent treatment. I would say, though, that in most cases, golf courses are using more of a temporary types of treatments instead. There was also some problems with Milky Spore that the virulence of the disease suffered to some degree. I mean, they had to grow this stuff in basically vats like you grow yogurt. And you know, there were some questions of their quality control that the original strains that were used in research weren't quite the same strains that were being commercially sold. But I think they've tried to clean that up. And as I said, what people are continuing to look at is more effective strains of these various bacteria for us to use.
Tammy, thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate the call. And on to Steve in Manchester, Wisconsin. Your turn now, Steve. Hi.
Top of the morning, lads. A simple question. I routinely find deceased and trapped box elder bugs and those things that look like ladybugs in my bathtub, and it's dry. How do they get trapped since they can fly?
Well, I think in most cases what you find at this time of the year with these things are waking up is they are on low gas tanks. They have very little energy and the like. And so it's really quite common, whether it's cluster flies or the like, that these things tend to expire shortly after waking up. I think, you know, the other thing with a bathtub, which is kind of a common thing with many insects, don't have the capacity to walk up the porcelain sides, you know. And so if they fall into there, you know, they struggle and they try to crawl. And as I said, many of them, I don't think, have the strength to be able to fly very well. If, you know, we were in the middle of summer and they were well fed, I think they would have no problem of flying out of that. But if they're weak enough that they can only crawl, as I said, it just takes. And we call these pitfall traps. We use versions of these sometimes outside in the ground to catch insects that, you know, come crawling in, fall in, and they get caught there. And then we can use them for surveying and those kind of things. But so I don't think there's anything, you know, it's not color related, anything else. As I said, I think it's the combination of just not having a whole lot of energy and then falling into a container that they're not capable of crawling out from.
So. There we go.
Well, that makes sense. I'll have to check it in the summer to see if they're still in there. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for calling. And let's see, Dawn in Deer Park, your turn. Hi, Dawn.
Hello there. I am wondering, I have a huge raspberry patch, and I inherited from my mother. And last year, I had an infestation of fruit flies. Mm-hmm. That I couldn't even hardly use any of the crop. I mean, it was just totally out of control, no matter how fast I picked berries or anything. And I looked it up, and I think it's the spotted wing.
Yep, yep.
Drosophila. Yeah.
Drosophila. Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what I can do so I don't lose my old crop this year.
Well, what makes this insect unique? Typical old-fashioned fruit flies would only attack your berries that were so ripe and whatnot, you probably wouldn't want to pick them. So they're kind of after the effect. But what makes the spotted-winged Drosophila so unique is the females are laying their eggs before your berries even color. So by the time you start to pick, you've lost the war by probably a number of days. And so this is where we get into the frustration with spotted wing. It becomes a high-maintenance insect. And there's some organic sprays. There's some non-organic sprays. But you basically have to gear up when they're starting to lay their eggs, which typically gets into July. I mean, sometimes some of the early varieties of raspberries we can get through. We get often our strawberry crop through without any problem. It's the fall bearing and whatnot that we get more pressure as the season goes on. So there's a product like spinosad, which is an organic product. It can be applied, but the problem with the applications of things is it only lasts for a few days. So now we're getting into 3, 4, 5 applications to get a crop through. And that's where it becomes the high maintenance. But unfortunately, you know, these things are mobile enough that there's nothing you magically can do on your property to make them go away for next year, because they'll just become flying in down the road. And you know, it's really been kind of unclear to us. We've been into this now for probably about 6-7 years, because I know it was a couple years before I retired that we saw the first spotted wing come in. It's gotten to the point that, honestly, a lot of commercial producers have stopped growing berries because it's just not worth their effort, you know, their costs and time and the like. But again, in your case, if you're willing to put up the fight, but in particular, as I'd mentioned, it's getting after them early. Now, what you will find on the internet is there are little traps you can put out that basically help you monitor when they show up, you know, and so you often don't have to spray until you start catching the first spotted wings in your traps. And then you know now is the time to start. And then until your crop is pretty much harvested, you're going to have to stay after it.
Can you put Dawn's got a strawberry bed, probably not an enormous one. Could she put a floating row cover over it, or would that not work?
I'm not sure it will be tight enough. You know, for something like Japanese beetle, they always come in from up above, and like it's a big critter, and, you know, they're not smart enough. fruit flies are just so notorious from going around that I have not seen any of those physical barriers, unless you had a self-contained house, you know, kind of like a screen house that you grew the berries in. Then you might be able to do it, but it would have to be relatively tight, because we've seen a lot of problems in some of the greenhouse type situations. People are trying to grow things that this is a problem for those people too.
Yeah, there we go. Don, I'm sorry.
So it's not something, I mean, the eggs aren't in the ground or anything. It's just they're coming.
Yeah, and so, you know, one of the things that we've been curious to watch is spotted-winged Drosophila can breed in a tremendous number of plants. It's probably breeding on a lot of wild berries and the like, so it's not just raspberries. And it goes through multiple generations. But the interesting question that we haven't quite is, they probably should be a problem earlier. In some parts of the country, they are a problem much earlier in the growing season than they are in Wisconsin. They really don't get started here, as I said, until we get into July. So it could be worse, unfortunately. And I don't think that's going to change. There's some dynamic here, as I said. Whether they go into what we call diapause or like, I just haven't been keeping up on the literature enough to know exactly what, if we've solved the riddle of what happens early season with them. But once they start, it's constant until they freeze out, basically.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Can you spell the name of that organic?
Okay, so one of the commercial names is Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew.
Okay.
It's also, the active ingredient is spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D.
Okay.
And it does have a label for raspberry. I think one of the problems is you're only allowed 4 applications a year.
Oh.
And there are some seasons that's going to cause a little bit of a problem because it's so extended. Now, pyrethrin is another organic spray, although it doesn't have quite the residual. But you will find some suggestions is you know, some organic alternatives that you can alternate. But as I said, the big thing is to being aggressive relatively early. Why this insect is capable of doing that is, unlike most fruit flies, the female has a little egg-laying device. It's like a saw, which allows her to cut into and lay the eggs into the berries, where, as I said, the average kinds of fruit flies we have don't have that, so they have to wait until the berry starts to decay before they can get into it.
Oh. Thank you so much for calling, Don. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus in the department. From the Department of Entomology, he headed the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison for many a year. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you listening in today. We have lots of callers online, so I think we're going to go right back to the phones and to Dan in Milwaukee. Dan, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Larry. Mm-hmm. I called Garden Talk just a few days ago and got some unfortunate news that my indoor garden had been spawning fungus gnats. I thought they were fruit flies at first. But I was just wondering, I thought, oh, here's another program that could answer a question of mine. What can I do to get rid of these fungus gnats, which have grown like more than 100 in my apartment and are terrifying my wife?
Okay. So, you know, there is a product in this. You probably won't pick it at a hardware store. You're probably going to have to go to some kind of plant store. But there is a bacterial insecticide that is made for killing the maggots of fungus gnats. It's a type of BT product, which is named for a particular bacteria. And there's a strain that kills flies, whether it's mosquitoes or fungus gnats. And so being this, if you've got pets and whatnot, we don't worry about it because it's just a bacteria that only affects that one subgroup of insects. And Natrol is one product, Nat Out, but there's a number of the products on the market, and you definitely can get it on the internet if you can't find it locally. And that probably is the easiest way. The problem with most insecticides that you would apply, which would probably kill the fungus gnats, in many cases cause plant injuries by, you know, pruning the roots and the like. Plus, the insecticides, you know, potentially have some other issues with pets and people in the like. So, as I said, I often find that the gnat product bacteria is, you know, you can use it on seedlings if you're growing tomatoes, you know, so it's a very broad use in a very reasonable product to use. It's just trying to chase it down. Sometimes it's kind of a specialty product, so not everybody carries it.
Yeah.
I understand. And so if I have a microgreen garden, you're saying there, it runs the chance of injuring my plants.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends, you know, what we tend to find, that what's causing the injury on the plants is more the solvents and carriers. So in general, the powdered insecticides are less likely to cause injury, whereas the liquid insecticides you mix with water is where we would see. And I remember, this is years ago, my colleague Chuck Koval, who was really kind of my mentor, was working with some insects that were bothering marigolds. And he was using drenches, so he'd put the stuff on. And it was a real subtle thing, because what he'd do is he'd delay the bloom of the plants by 3 weeks, and that's because of the root damage. And if you didn't have the comparison, you wouldn't pick it up. But in other cases, what you see is the plants either stop growing or you can kill the plants because of the phytotoxicity of the chemical, whereas this bacteria product, whether you get it as a powder that you mix or there are some liquid suspensions that you mix and you just do the normal watering, and as I said, what happens then is the little fungus gnat maggots ingest the spores, and that's what does them in.
All righty. I appreciate it, Phil, and thank you, Larry.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Dan. Appreciate it. And Harold in Schofield. Your turn, Harold. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I just had a comment on the Asian beetles. Got a cabin up by Tomahawk, and we put shutters on for winter in the fall to keep people from breaking in, and they don't fit tight. So typically the Asian beetles go in, and then in the fall they leave, or in the spring. So I, neighbor up there said I should spray for them, so I did that one fall around the windows and the doors. And the only problem is they must have ate the spray, and they went in, and then they died rather than leave in the spring. So then I had a cleanup problem. So that might be something to consider.
Yeah, yeah. You know, in one of the interesting things is, you know, one insect begets another. And so it turns out that all the dead bodies of these various box elder bugs and stuff that are in your attic and wall spaces serve as food for carpet beetles. And so sometimes when I would, in the lab, get a sample of carpet beetle infestations, we would talk to the people, and that's what it turned out to be, is that they would get all these fall invaders, and, you know, a good percentage of them don't make it. And normally you'd say that's no big deal. Well, it is a big deal if you get carpet beetles, because then carpet beetles also will feed on woolens and silk. And so, it's frustrating. Now, the interesting thing about many of the sprays that are being used now probably work as much as a repellent as they do as a killer. And so if you get them on early enough, the lady beetles or cluster flies don't want to land on the surface. They are repelled by the product. And so there's a kind of a double action there. But once they get in the walls and you spray, if they get to the chemicals, then they're going to die, as you say. And then you're going to have to clean them up if you can.
Thanks, Harold. Another good point. Let's go to Norman next in Wausau. Hi, Norman.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to tell Phil something that's of interest and then ask him a question. The first thing is we have a bad problem up here with the fruit flies on the cane berries like everybody else, and I found one solution for our blueberries that worked just perfect last year. Will it work this year? I don't know. But I brought bridal veil material. It's 100 inches wide. I sewed three strips together, about 36 feet long. I put some fiberglass posts, 5-6 foot posts in with yogurt cuts on top, so the veil material didn't get torn. Put it down nicely all around the edge, and I did it right after the blossoms fell off. I sprayed it once at that time with a fungicide and an insecticide. And, you know, I didn't have a single bug in there. I didn't even have a mosquito. I could sit on my 6-gallon can and pick my blueberries in peace that were absolutely perfect. The question I have to ask Phil, though, is, Phil, do you know anything that really works well for aphids that won't kill my citrus plants? I've been struggling with it all winter. I still have 3 citrus plants left. I killed 2. I was using that soap spray they talk about, and I tried permethrin spray, and it seems to help for a couple of days, and then they're right back. And I'm wondering if I killed them. by spraying them too much?
Well, you know, the soap itself, as in any product, can cause some phytotoxicity. And that's why, you know, when we talk to people, there's a lot of soaps you can buy at the grocery store and use. But the dosage is a problem. And if you put too much of a soap in the mixture, it will cause the physical burn of the plant. So it could. Now, the problem with what's so interesting about the citrus plants is if, you know, in the summer, if you take those plants and put them out onto the deck, the aphid populations will just crash naturally because of the natural control. The problem with them in a sheltered case like the sun room is there's no native control critters, and that's why the populations explode. Now, what makes aphids so problematic is they've got two ways of getting through reproducing. They can either lay eggs, which are almost impossible to kill, or they give birth to live young. And for the most part, you expect this continuous breeding in birth to live young. But because they do that, you never, ever seem to be able to control aphids with one treatment. There always has to be two to three. And coverage is a big issue. Because with the soaps, if you miss, you know, three or four leaves, you've got survivors that are going to repopulate things. And so that, you know, in the greenhouse, they often talk about there, you know, you basically have to shake the plant with the force of the spray to make sure you get the coverage and get it down in all the nooks and crannies. And it's just not practical. I think a lot of cases in sunrooms, they have the kind of equipment, or if you're using that much pressure, then you've got the soap going in all kinds of places you don't want. So it does get frustrating. Now, there are some systemic products. There are some products that you can put in the soil that will help knock back the aphids. It will not control them completely.
And we'll talk about what those products are after we take a look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Our guest, Phil Pelletieri, great to have him back. News, though, next on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at insects today with our guest, Phil Pelletieri. I'm Larry Mueller. Phil's an entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Great to have him back. Certainly great to have you listening in. Insect problems or just a question about bugs, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Ideas Network Facebook page. Norman in Wausau was with us just before we broke for news.
So as I was, we were starting to talk about putting things in the soil. There are plant spikes that contain some systemic insecticides that will move through the sap of the plant and give you upwards of 5 to 6 weeks worth of control. They never eliminate the populations because they just don't move uniformly. So aphids that are on older tissue don't get exposed as much. But they're often convenient to hold. And as I said, in particular, I think if you're going to be moving these plants outside like many people do, then just let the natural control go on from there. But some people believe that they're going to control the population. And as I said, what they do is they knock it back drastically. And then when the insecticide starts to peter out, you start to see a resurgence of the aphids. And so that's normal. But it may be convenient. You can find these things, and they basically, it's proportional to the diameter of the plant, will tell you how many plant spikes to use. And they seem to be very convenient. And interesting enough, you know, these products are even labeled if people are harvesting the citrus. There's an extended delay, but they can even be used in cases on stuff that people are harvesting the fruit. So that may be a way to kind of knock things down, because as I said, I think the dilemma is to get the kind of coverage you need from the soap. If you insist that you use the soap, make sure you get the regular insecticidal soap so it doesn't have any of those solvents and carriers that are often what cause the phytotoxicity, and do not use more than they suggest. They go with a relatively mild 1% solution and get as good a coverage as you can, and definitely follow up probably 5 to 7 days from the first application with another application to have any chance to get them under control.
There we go. Thanks again, Norman, for calling. Rusty in Marshall, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Larry. I started a beehive last spring, and all summer long my bees were busy and building combs and doing what bees do. And I'm just worried about how they've survived through the winter and because it was very warm last Wednesday, I was working outdoors in my T-shirt, and I just wonder if this cold snap would affect them. I'm concerned about my bees.
Sure. Have you checked on them at all to see how the colony is doing this winter?
Well, I opened the lid when it was still cold out, and I could see a mass of bees that, I don't know, looked rather, I don't know exactly what I was looking at. I'm new at this sort of thing. And
yeah.
Well, you know, the only reason I ask, I will confess to you, I'm definitely, bees are not my expertise, but the things that I know in general, that this past winter has been really very tough, just the extent of the winter, you know, a lot of the problems has to do with the colonies being kind of weakened to start because of the mite problems, and people are having trouble getting the mites under control. And so I saw the reports 5-6 weeks ago of, you know, 40-50% of the bee colonies not making it, which isn't, I mean, traditionally, even before the mites got here, we were losing a third of our bees. I mean, that's just, this is a tough climate to get through. You know, hopefully there is enough honey. I mean, if there's enough food sources, your bees will just be fine. And so I was just wondering if during the warm spell you saw any signs of activity, because the bees probably should have been carrying waste out of the colony and in doing those kind of housekeeping things. But, you know, when you open it up, you know, sometimes you find that the cluster of bees just aren't moving. I mean, you should see some signs of movement because, you know, what the bees are doing is generating heat by, you know, buzzing their wings in that activity. That's what allows them to get through the winter and the like. And so, you know, sometimes the group of bees will be in a part of the comb where there's no honey, and because it's so cold, they can't move down to where the honey is. And so that's part of the game of manipulating the food stores so the bees can have access to it. You know, I think the good news now is things are going to change so quickly, you know, at least the way the weather people are promising, then, you know, a couple days isn't going to make a whole lot of difference for it. And so hopefully the colony has made it through. But if it does, consider yourself one of the lucky ones, because as I said, this has been, I think, more than the norm, a tough winter, the combination of just what the weather patterns are. And as I said, just the general feedback of the difficulty of keeping the varroa mites in particular knocked down enough so that the colonies can go into the winter with enough bees and enough food stores to be able to have hope of getting through.
Should I introduce some food in there, some honey?
If you've got some honey and they're still active, yes. I mean, that would that would be a good idea if you can. You know, sometimes people use, here's where, again, I don't have the expertise, but do use some sucrose, you know, water solutions to give the bees some quick energy if they have to once they become active, if they're concerned that there's not any food stores available. But yeah, definitely making honey available if it looks like there's none to get the bees through, or the supply is so dwindling that you get some concern. But boy, you know, the nice thing is if we get into weather where the bees can start flying and when things start to bloom within the next week or two, you know, that'll turn them around real quick. But as I said, I got my fingers crossed for you, because it just has not been a good winter to get the bees to where we want them.
Good luck,
okay,
Rusty.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And John in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm just wondering if you can give me some tips on some carpenter ant issues. I recently got a house, and when I was pulling apart insulation in the basement and then one window upstairs, pretty clear evidence that there were carpenter ants. I didn't see anything active, but just yesterday I found one in the basement. It was a little groggy. It was on the floor. Just wondering if you have some tips for carpenter ants.
Sure. So the good news is the carpenter ants don't eat wood. They just live in weakened wood. And so, you know, I go back to, as Larry knows, I've been trying to write a book, and one of my more frustrating but favorite stories was of a case of somebody that was told that the only way they could solve the carpenter ant problem is to take every piece of wall off the house to get down to the studs to find out where the ants were. And it just was not a good decision. What people overreact to is if you've got a bad windowsill and the ants move into, when you find it, people say, well, the ants ruined my windowsill. Well, no, they didn't. The water and the rot ruined it, and the ants moved in afterwards. Now, because you've seen an ant, and with all the things that are going on outside, there is a colony somewhere still in the house. But if you're going through, you know, a renovation and, you know, checking where there appears to be moisture problems, the physical replacement of the bad stuff is enough. The other thing what you might find is that windowsill, there could have been ants in there 10 years ago. The colony has died out and everything's, you know, fine. And so I wouldn't get too concerned there. The one way, there's two things that are going on now that have changed versus when I first started. One is there are commercial carpenter ant baits available where you put it down, the ants pick it up, take it back. And the best time to use the baits are in the spring. So you're ahead of the game there. Although if you go that direction, you're going to have to go on the internet. I don't know of any place that you can buy these over the counter, but you can go to these do-your-own pest control services, and they will sell you the various baits made specifically, or you can hire a professional pest control service. The other thing that has changed is we always used to treat carpenter ants by treating the outside foundation. That really was more for keeping outside ants from coming indoors, but there is a spray that's used by pest control firms. If you spray the outside just once, doesn't matter if the ants are coming in from outside or inside, they go through it. And what makes this product unique is it doesn't repel the ants. The old products, you put it, the ants didn't come in because they didn't want to cross the barrier, which doesn't control the ants. It just keeps them out of the house, which is part of what we try to do. In your case, where the colony's inside, the first thing I would normally say is if you can find the colony and treat it, you know, that would be the best solution. But if you can't find the colony, the bait would be one option. You know, provide the baits to them, let them take it back and kill the queen. Or the other option is if you had a commercial spraying done on the outside of the house, when the ants go outside to forage for food, which they'll do most of the time during the summer, they will go through this product, pick it up, and they literally transfer to other ants. And so what we're finding is carpenter ants have become a lot easier to control in the last 10 years or so versus where we were before. But don't overreact. I mean, they're not going to make your house fall down. If you feel more comfortable with just doing what you're doing is, you know, checking on the sill plates and other things to see where you see activity, to see if there's enough of a pattern. If all the ants disappeared behind the kitchen sink, I'd say, you know, it's worth going to the hardware store, buying an ant spray, and spray into that wall void a couple times just to see if that will do it. Or, as I had mentioned, you know, get the commercial baits, make the baits available, and let the ants take care of it themselves. But it isn't that big a deal, is I guess what I'm saying. People think these are a version of termites, and they're not. I mean, termites eat wood for a living. Carpenter ants feed on sugar and protein, and they nest in rotting wood is what their favorite place to be is.
There we go. Thanks, John. Appreciate the call. And Lorraine in De Pere, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I was calling about the young man who called about fungus gnats around his plant. A couple of other options. One of them is I have a small greenhouse, and I have a butterwort plant scattered amongst the plants that I have, and they exude a sticky substance on their leaves. The fungus gnats are attracted. They stick to the leaves, and the plant adjusts them. And the second solution is sticky traps. They come on yellow paper, and it's with a commercial sticky product. The yellow attracts the fungus gnats, and the sticky keeps them there, and then they just die on the paper. And so once you collect most of the adults, you're not going to have a breeding population anymore.
Yeah, I don't, you know, and the yellow also works for aphids. I mean, they do make this special, it's a special color of yellow, which is more attractive. And again, I think it's greenhouses are primarily where they use. The butterwort is very interesting. I never heard of that as a control option. You know, both of them will help reduce. You know, I don't think we necessarily need 100% control, and I would think that neither of those would be 100%, but they probably can reduce the adult populations enough that it doesn't have a nuisance, and then is kind of where the gentleman might want to go. But the only complaint I've heard on the sticky traps is if you got pets, it seems
the
pets like to get in the sticky traps. But other than that, those are both physical methods. And, you know, we use these in the greenhouses also as a way of monitoring. I mean, you put up the sticky card trap, you will catch insects before you visually see them. And so it tells people problems are coming. So they're very effective that way, too.
Yeah. Thanks, Lorraine.
You're welcome.
And Patty in Eden had called to say the same thing. She had great luck getting rid of fungus gnats by using those sticky yellow traps. So good. Let's go to Connie next in Oconomowoc. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Larry. I have a question to Phil concerning mealworms.
Okay.
We've had an infestation for the past 3 summers, and it's getting worse. They come into our basement level by the hundreds. Our basement is very dry, so it's not like they're finding liquid. It starts in June. It goes about 4 or 5 weeks. We've tried diatomaceous earth, both outside and inside, which as they crawl over it, then they eventually die. But the amount is just increasing every year. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering why it started. And
yeah, I don't think they're mealworms. Now, mealworms to me is something that would breed in dog food, and they're big, light yellow creatures. And I just don't expect them to invade. If you had a problem, it was because you had to have a bag of dog food back in the corner of the basement you forgot about. With this continued invasion, it sounds like millipedes to me.
Millipedes.
And right. The problem with millipedes, they breed in soil on organic matter, and they crawl around at night. And then when the sun comes up, they look for sheltered places. And that's what often drives them in. You know, people find them on the slabs of their garage floor because it's cool and damp and dark. But also if they can squeeze in underneath between the siding and your foundation, they end up in the basement and they die relatively quickly. But they just keep coming in. And, you know, we've talked on the show before of people who get them. The numbers are staggering. It can be. But the frustration is, you know, people often talk, like we've mentioned for some of these other insects, is you put sprays around the outside foundation to try to catch them to come in. But, you know, they'll crawl through the spray, still die inside. And to me, with the frustration of millipedes is we know for a fact in many cases they're migrating from hundreds of yards away. You know, that the source. So it's not like you can go to the breeding site and treat it and stop this whole process. So anything you can do to keep the outside foundation drier will help. But I think more importantly, the weakness, if you're getting that many creatures in, is often where the siding meets the foundation. If you push up in there with your hands, you can see how insects can easily crawl in. And it's kind of like going over the top of a fence. They fall in the basement. So by caulking and sealing that up physically as best you can, you keep them on the outside. And at least you won't have that frustration of having them in the basement. Now, trying to stop them totally in your yard is going to be really quite difficult, as I said, because my guess is they're coming in from a distance away, that you won't have control over it. It's more of a rural type of problem. Usually in the city where houses are so close to each other, there's just not enough organic matter to breed the kind of millipede populations to cause a problem. But if you've got, you know, nice fields and prairies, and even in cases of agricultural land, we find that they can breed in tremendous numbers and then continue to migrate in. And that seems to be the pattern that you've been seeing.
Okay. Now, we were considering having a company come in to treat our home. Should that not be something we should?
Well, no reason to treat indoors, because that's not the source. And as I said, okay, you can try it, but what my concern is it, you know, will give you some, you know, a few days, few weeks at best, but then they're going to continue to migrate in. And, you know, we had talked earlier, if you kill 90% of the insects, you know, we're happy with the success of it, but the 10% that get by, when you start to talk about thousands of millipedes migrating in, you're still probably going to see some make their way in the basement. That's, you could probably do as well. I mean, there's nothing wrong with commercial people, and, you know, they have the expertise, I think, to have the best chance of success, but you can buy similar products at the hardware store and apply it. So you're kind of weighing the cost of having somebody come in. And I think a person that's really doing a good service will kind of sit down with you and give you some suspicions where they think the source of this is. Maybe something you can do to help that out, although often you can't. As I said, because I love the story. Stan Temple, I know, who's on the show quite a bit. Stan had a millipede problem, and Stan was tracking how quickly the millipedes move. And if I remember right, he was telling me he could track one 100 yards in less than 5 minutes. So it gives you an idea of how far away at night these things literally can be crawling from. And that's why it's so frustrating, because I don't think they're breeding in your yard. There's not enough organic matter there. But when you get into prairies, old fields, CRP, all those other things, there's enough dead vegetation that's where the millipedes do quite well.
So the you might be better off spending a little money to hire somebody to work along the
right
physically.
You know, and that's the thing. Very few pest control services, unfortunately, offer, we call it proofing, because you know, you can build mice out, you can build insects out, and in many pest control services don't offer that as an option. If you've got one that does, it's well worth it, because as I said, if you've got somebody that understands how to do this correctly, it can make a permanent solution to a lot of these nuisance problems.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling, Connie. Appreciate it. Chuck wondered from Viroqua about ticks, about protective sprays or whatever you could use on clothing, what you recommend. How many washings can the, you know, treatment withstand?
It depends on the formulation. The most common stuff is permethrin. There are many products you can buy at sporting goods and whatnot that will go through 4 to 5 washings. There are even clothing you can buy if you spend a lot of time outdoors that are impregnated with this stuff that'll go through 100 washings. And there's as much repellency, but the whole idea with these products is they kill the tick before it has an opportunity to feed on you long enough to transmit a disease. You know, with most of the deer tick diseases, we're talking 36 to 48 hours of feeding on you before you have a chance of getting sick. And so if you can kill them well before that, and that's what these products do. So various names, but if you look under the active ingredient, 95% of what I've seen out there is permethrin, P-E-R-M-I-T-H-R-I-N. And it's good to buy the stuff that's made for put on clothing. You can buy other formulations. There's even a termite formulation of this stuff. You know, I've seen people trying to cut corners. They buy the termite stuff, they soak it in, but what they don't realize, it's got the same active ingredient, but the dosage is wrong. And there are other carriers and other products mixed with the termite product that I wouldn't want to put on my skin. Whereas the stuff that's made for label for clothing, that's what it's for. In many cases, they'll suggest to have the clothing off, spray, let it dry, which only takes, you know, 5 minutes at best. Then you can put the clothing on. And as I said, it will even go through 2 or 3 washings and still be effective. So you don't have to apply it daily or 3 or 4 times a day like you do some of the mosquito repellents, the DEET products. They work in a different manner. This really isn't a repellent. It really kills them.
Frances, it's your turn next. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
We have hornets that got in somehow in between the wall, and they chewed the drywall on the inside of the wall. They build those nests that are in sheets in there, and I don't know how far down they went. How I discovered them, I was painting the wall, and they pulled the paint off a layer of paint, and it was all underneath that layer of paint. And it's drywall, and I can't figure out how they chewed the drywall. Somebody, so how can I know I'm going to have to try to get somebody to come here and do it all the outside, because this is a brick home, and there's those little holes up there, and
Sure. Okay, so the good news is the hornets that were there are dead, you know, and so we're starting everything from scratch. So your concern is if one finds its way in. Literally, there are products to put in the little weep holes of the brick for exactly this reason, is there are insects that squeeze in, and this will allow to get some airflow, but yet enough of a physical protection. So, you know, it's a little bit tedious to go that direction, but that would seem to be a more permanent solution to me, is that if you can figure where their access points are and stop that. And as I said, there are products on the market made specifically for putting in weep holes, preventing insects from getting access. Then they can't get into the wall space. If they can't get in the wall space, they won't build a nest. And, you know, you've got some time to play with, because we're probably not going to see the hornets and yellow jackets move in until, I'm guessing, end of May, beginning of June.
So it's going to be a little bit anyway. The cold weather is helping.
Yeah,
nobody's
woken up yet. So,
there you go. Well, I tell you what, we are out of time, Phil. As always, been a lot of fun. We talked to a lot of people. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit. I think you're back June 20th.
Well, I'm going to be fishing, so I'm going to try to talk PJ into doing that one.
So. Okay, so maybe PJ Leash will be back in June 20th. In the meantime, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. Still working on his book. We'll learn. When he's finished, he'll be on to talk about the book. April is National Car Care Month, and tomorrow at this time, vehicle maintenance expert Jim Ward back to talk about what you need to do to keep your car in good shape. That's at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.